Studio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. We're speaking to Jim DiEugenio, needs no introduction, from Los Angeles, from sunny Los Angeles. Hello, Jim.
Well, sunny is probably about a little underestimating it, Len. Okay, it's pretty hot out here. You know, the thing about California is supposed to has a Mediterranean kind of a climate, you know, because the winds come in off the ocean. They try and get over the Sierra Madre Mountains, and they can't, but they get up to the snow caps, and that cools the air, and then when it blasts back into the ocean, you know, you get a dehumidifier effect, and that's what makes the Southern California climate so terrific, all right? The only thing better I've ever been to is Hawaii, all right? Okay, but that's not – it was 95 today, okay, in Burbank. You know, so it's really these people who say there's no such thing as a greenhouse effect. You know, they're up a tree. Anyway, let's get to our subject here, which is always the assassinations of the 1960s. And let's take a look at Kennedy's and King. And I want to say, first of all, before we get to that, I did a review of the movie called Oppenheimer. That is out, just came out a few days ago. And it's over at Consortium News. And the reason that I'm bringing it up is because in the film, they very briefly mention JFK, all right? Because as a senator, he voted against the appointment of Louis Strauss to be the Secretary of Commerce. And Louis Strauss had been the guy who had drummed Robert Oppenheimer out of the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, I don't have to explain to this audience who Robert Oppenheimer was, because he, of course, was the brilliant physicist, the polymath, who Leslie Groves appointed to run the Manhattan Project. And to put it mildly, Oppenheimer did a very good job. Okay, and at less than 3 years, he devised two ways to detonate an atomic bomb, you know, one with uranium and one with plutonium. And that, of course, ended up with the explosion at Los Alamos in July of 1945, where they actually detonated a plutonium bomb. Oppenheimer always thought that he was essentially working for the military, because Groves had appointed him, and that although he allowed people to question what they were doing, in the end, he felt that they were working for another body above them. He didn't feel that way after, okay? And since he had become the most famous scientist in America, cover of Time magazine, and he was dissenting about the hydrogen bomb, he was essentially drummed out of the Atomic Energy Commission by a combination of J. Edgar Hoover, Louis Strauss, who became the chair of that commission, and Edward Teller, the physicist who had worked under him and who wanted to develop the hydrogen bomb. All right. And he went through a security clearance hearing, which was completely rigged, as I describe in the review. and he was voted out 2-1 on the day before his consultancy ended. And that shows you how politically motivated it was. Slowly but surely, in 1959, Strauss was rejected as Secretary of Commerce in a very strong hearing against what he had done to Oppenheimer. And Kennedy cast one of the votes in a very close vote, 49-46, against Strauss. He was convinced by his former Harvard dean, McGeorge Bundy, that what Strauss had done to Oppenheimer was a kangaroo court, which it was. And I talk about this in the review. All right. Then in 1962, Kennedy invited Oppenheimer to his famous Nobel laureates dinner, except Oppenheimer never won a Nobel, but evidently Kennedy wanted him there as part of his rehabilitation. Then in 1963, before he was assassinated, Kennedy appointed the Enrico Fermi Award to be given to Oppenheimer, all right? But Kennedy was killed, and so Johnson went through the ceremony. After the ceremony, Jackie Kennedy requested to see him privately, and she told him words of the effect that giving him that award was one of the highest wishes that her late husband had, okay? I really wish the movie would have ended with that scene, but it didn't. But that's not even the end of the story. On the day Kennedy was assassinated, Oppenheimer's son came into his office at Princeton. He was a director of the Advanced Institute there and told him what had happened. And then his secretary rushed in and she confirmed it. And so Oppenheimer went over to the liquor cabinet to pour his son a drink, him and his son a drink, except he couldn't pour the drink because his hand was trembling, all right? And so they walked out to watch the TV coverage. And as they left the room, Oppenheimer said, well, everything is now going to fall apart pretty fast. You know, I can't make this stuff up. I really can't, you know. This is almost, you know, a realm of fiction, but it's not. It's in the book. I think I was the only reviewer who read the book, American Prometheus, okay, which was by Kai Bird and the late Marty Sherwin, all right, and the 600 pages, but I decided I had to read it if I was going to review the film. And so that stuff is in there, okay?
And that's what the film is based on, that book?
Yeah, it's based on that book. Okay, although the only time that the film mentions Kennedy is concerning his vote in the Strauss affair. I think it would have been a better film, and I mentioned this in my review, you know, if they would have ended that scene with that scene between Jackie Kennedy and Oppenheimer. You know, I really do. I mean, the film is worth seeing. Okay, I don't want to detract anybody from seeing the movie, you know, but I made some criticisms which are in the review. But it's the best feature film I've ever seen on the Manhattan Project. Okay. All right. So that's out of the way. All right. We have two new articles on the site. Okay.
Well, can I interrupt you for one moment? Just before we get
Len, to... Len, this is your show, so yes, you can do it.
Oh, no. Okay. But I mean, just, you know, out of courtesy, just before we get into what's on there, there was an item in the news, I think, last week that you didn't cover, and I just want to know if you just want to talk about that quickly. Just
What is it?
That the court case, you know, Biden overturning the ability to get this JFK Records Act out, that has...
We did talk about that.
Well, no, we didn't talk about it since they had... I just want to, if you could give an update on that.
Yeah, of course I am.
Right.
Yeah, of course I am. In fact, that's one of the things I'm going to mention.
Okay, all right, sure, good, all right.
All right, the two new articles, there's one on the Sixth Floor Museum, Leno Sanek's favorite place, by Mark Mahoney, which is a pretty good review of what that place is really about. And in fact, the director has already read the review. I know this for sure because I saw an email by him. And he acknowledged that he read the review. Now, the other new article is an absolutely excellent, excellent essay on Biden's attempt to halt any further release of documents in the JFK case. And it's by Andrew Eiler, a Canadian, and Mark Adamczyk from Florida. These two guys, to say that they know their stuff is a monumental understatement, okay? And I can't recommend this article strongly enough for people to read, because what these guys do is they show how this executive order by Biden on June the 30th actually contradicts the whole JFK Act, which, as we know, was passed back in the 90s, you know, and then created the ARB. And it does so in more than one way. For example, Biden actually said that his last document dump was going to be the last act of the JFK collection. But how can that be, okay, if the ARB, the whole thing about the JFK Collections Act is that every document should be declassified? Let me read off a little bit here. Section 5G2D. Each assassination record shall be publicly disclosed in full and available in the collection no later than the date that is 25 years after the date of enactment of this act, okay, unless the president certifies, as required by this act, that there should be a continued postponement. In other words, the president had to specifically describe why each document should be withheld. To put it mildly, that hasn't happened. In fact, it hasn't happened at all. Now, according to Jeff Morley, there's about 4,000 or a little bit more documents that are still being withheld. So in other words, the president was supposed to write up a reason why such a document was being withheld. And there should have been identification aid, which gives you the metadata about what the document is. Now, that didn't happen at all under Trump or under Biden. Now, let me read something else from here. The act specifically weighs in on the president's ongoing ministerial duties with respect to postponement of assassination records. That section mandates that after the ARB has made a final determination regarding the release or postponement of an assassination record, okay, only the president has sole authority to release or postpone the record under the standards of Section 6, which means that you have to have a ongoing operation or an agent in place. Well, if we don't know why the thing is being withheld, then how can anybody object to the disclosure? And that's the whole thing about the JFK Collections Act, because it was now supposed to go ahead and shift the burden of proof to the other side. Okay. In other words, instead of under a Freedom of Information Act, where the burden of proof was on the plaintiff, the person bringing the suit, now it's supposed to be the defendant. Well, what happened here is that's now being reversed by Biden. Okay. Let me read something else from here. This is part section 12B. The remaining provisions of this act shall continue in effect until such time as the archivist certifies to the president and the Congress that all assassination records have been made available to the public in accordance with this act. How can you get more clear than that? Let me repeat this. How can you get more clear than that? And how can it be more obvious that what Biden and the CIA have done is now neutered that clause? Okay. So in other words, what I'm saying is, and what these two guys are saying, Andrew and Mark, is that what has happened here is that the White House, in cahoots with the CIA, because the CIA put together what they call the transparency plan, which is supposed to take away the rest of the documents from the archivist and give it to something called the National Declassification Board. And there, of course, the CIA, the FBI, the Secret Service will all be able, State Department, whatever, they will all be able to go ahead and make their case as to when the document should be released. And this is what I mean. This is a complete reversal of what the act was supposed to be about. Okay, now, another thing they bring up that, and I blame this on the intelligence committees in both the Senate and the House, that in Section 5 of the Act, there's a provision that contains something called a periodic review of postponed assassination records. And that was supposed to have been done, okay, on a regular basis, all right? And by reviewing, they were supposed to go ahead and declassify more documents as time went on under review. Well, that didn't happen. According to these guys, that did not really happen. And that's why Biden has been able to do these document dumps, okay, in the last several months, because there's been no periodic review by any official body. And according to these guys, because of that, the whole idea of an identification index to the documents really doesn't exist. It's really kind of abysmal, all right? It's hard enough to determine how many documents are being withheld, let alone what they're about, okay? So what this amounts to, I believe, is the White House and the CIA essentially giving the middle finger to the JFK Record Collections Act. I believe that this is diametrically opposed to what they were. And remember, the act passed, I believe it was unanimous in both houses. And Biden was one of the people who voted for it. So it's very odd, you know, that there's been a complete reversal on this. All right. Let me read another part of this. Let's be blunt. The president's transparency plans, originated by the CIA, are the opposite of transparent. They might as well be called opacity plans if the truth is being told. All right. The JFK Act is one big statutory transparency plan that mandates tracking forms or identification aids and a directory of those aids to provide transparency for each and every document in the Record Collections Act, including those that are being held in secret protected collection. Biden's transparency plan seeks to do away with the identification aid program and publicly accessible directory of identification aids. It also, let me make this one last point about it. It also changes what most attorneys will call the burden, the level of proof, okay, that is decided, okay, for when it's possible to go ahead and keep a document secret. Okay, as these guys discuss in here, you know, there's three levels of proof that are commonly used in courts and administrative law. There's beyond a reasonable doubt. There's clear and convincing evidence. And the third one is preponderance of the evidence. But what happened here is that they kind of made up a level of proof, which is the reason why that somehow the White House could delay something. And that's sort of like this. It's like whenever the president decides that the problems in security outweigh the disclosure, then he can go ahead and opt for security. Now, that there is no such standard like that, okay? unless you identify the document and explain what it is. So they just kind of made that up, you know? And so this becomes now a very, very difficult problem that I really don't know how it's going to be solved. You know, I mean, Bill Kelly has recommended going to the Intel committees, okay, in both the House and the Senate, which, you know, you'd wonder why that won't work, you know, because the Republicans are always after Biden for everything. Why don't they get after him for this, you know? You know, the other thing is that I have not seen one article on this in whatever you want to call it, the corporate media, the MSM, or whatever. I haven't seen one article on this. You know, this article at Kennedy's and King is by far and away the most important article you're going to read, you know, on what Biden and the CIA have done here.
Well, you know, it's just another footprint, fingerprint, that they're responsible. And like you say, 60 years later, they're giving the middle finger to the public and saying, no, we're not going to release anything. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I fall back on is Trump saying, hey, if you saw what I saw, you'd know we can never release this.
Yeah, well, we're never going to, if you go by this, we're never going to know if that's true or not. You know, well, see, the thing is, as these two guys point out, all right, if you read the JFK Collections Act, all right, as time goes on, the bias towards disclosure is supposed to outweigh the case for classification as time goes on. Well, now what's happened is that Biden and the CIA have unilaterally said that we're going to go ahead and decide what can be seen and what cannot be seen. All right. So this is so bizarre, all right, that, you know, okay, let me read exactly what the standard is now, according to this article. Okay. Quote, except when the strongest possible reasons counsel otherwise. Let me read that again. Except when the strongest possible reasons counsel otherwise. This is in the June 30th executive order. And as the authors say, that is not a standard of proof imposed by the JFK Records Act. All right. And in fact, except when the strongest possible reasons counsel otherwise, that's not a standard of proof anywhere, in any court, in any administrative court, in any legal court. All right, so this is what I mean. These guys are just made up this new standard. You know, as the article says, the standard that, excuse me, that was in the act was a very, very high standard. Okay? All right, and you had to prove the security problem, or you had to prove the agent in place problem. You had to write it up. And so therefore, if you were going to go ahead and use that as an out, you had to at least supply the metadata for what the document was maintaining. See, with this new standard, okay, now you don't have either. You don't really have to explain, and you don't have to provide an identification aid, you know. Now, the opening paragraph, and by the way, in the article, you'll see there's a link to Biden's executive order, and there's also a link to the JFK Act, so you can compare them, okay. The opening paragraph of Biden's memorandum presents a perplexing statement and completely non-compliant decision. Quote, with my final certification made in this memorandum, the last required under the Act, and definitive plans for future disclosure, my administration is fulfilling the promise of transparency to the American people, unquote. That is one of the biggest piles of crap since the Warren Commission, okay? All right, because it wasn't up to the White House to make a final certification, okay? You know, it wasn't his job, okay, to make any definitive plan, all right? It was his job to identify the document and explain why it still had to be withheld. But after 2017, what possible reason could there be? All right. So I really have a very serious problem with this, you know, and I hope everybody else does also. Okay. And like I said, this is absolutely a first-class article on this subject, which you will not see anywhere else even close. Okay. And I have to say, I have to give these guys a lot of credit, Mark Adamczyk and Andrew Eiler. And as you know, Mark, I think, has been on your show, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I tried to get him on here a week or two ago, but he's actually on vacation. So,
oh, okay.
Remember,
right.
He texted me just saying that he's on, I think it's a boat cruise or something like that. So maybe he was able to write the article for you and email it in, but I think something happened and he was just too busy on holiday. So anyway.
All right. I just want everybody to know that as hard as I'm trying to do this, I'm not going to be as good as those two guys. So I strongly recommend you read the article and maybe we can get Andrew on. All right. So anyway, that's the state of what's going on with this JFK Act, which is really, really, I believe, troubling, you know, and disturbing. All right. And I can't accent that, you know, enough. Okay. I mean, it's very disappointing to see the law broken about this case, which has been sort of like, I hate to say this, standard operating procedure, you know, for a very long time, unfortunately. All right. I think also that they're going to do an article about the Seaborg decision in the Mary Farrell case. Okay, also. And that should be up probably by the next time I'm on your show.
Sure, right. For those who don't know it, you want to just give us a brief?
Yeah, this is the lawsuit brought by the Mary Farrell Foundation with Gary Aguilar and Chink Thompson as the two plaintiffs, because they live in Northern California, and that's where the lawsuit was filed. Okay. And the Seaborg decision came down a couple weeks ago. All right. And it's a decidedly mixed bag, okay, on the points that the judge granted and the points that he didn't grant. Okay. And so they're going to do an article about that. Okay. You know, which will be, I believe, highly informative. And what can be done now after the Seaborg decision has been filed. You know, and by the way, I should add that one of the reasons it was filed up there is because they thought they would get a better judge in the Northern California district than they would in Washington or even Massachusetts, because I think the Mary Farrell Foundation is headquartered in Massachusetts, you know, and Washington, of course, is where the documents are. Okay, but they decided to file in the Northern California district. And I think Seaborg was Obama appointed as a judge. So that's the latest on the two legal fronts. Okay. And let me, we only have three letters this time. Okay. June 28th, June 29th, and June the 30th. Gregory Giorgio. Kennedy's and King has outdone itself with the critique of the program hosted by Aaron Maté with guest Chris Hedges. One of the most enlightening pieces, which makes the critical distinctions about how some from the left want to paint also called liberals as deficient to their revolutionary agendas. DiGenio has stripped the fakers clean, and they are probably still clueless that their understanding of history is feckless and bare. Thanks for a great piece. Greg Giorgio, Altamont, New York. Okay. Well, I'm glad you liked that, Giorgio, and I think it's something that needed to be written because I think a lot of these people. Well, let me say something about this a little bit more, expand the point a little. I believed, and I think a lot of people believed, that the online and cable revolution that took place in the 90s, I believed that this was going to be a great opportunity to bring back the glory days of leftist journalism. Okay, which to me has always been Ramparts Magazine. Okay, which was, I believe, the greatest post-World War II magazine ever published. The LA, and the other example would be the Art Kunkin's LA Free Press, which I believe was the best weekly tabloid post-World War II ever published. Okay. If you want to see my article about Ramparts, if you don't know what that is, or if you're too young, okay, I think it's called Warren Hinckel and the Glory That Was Ramparts. And it was upon his death that I wrote it. Okay, and it's probably the best summary conclusion you're ever going to read about that absolutely superb magazine. Okay, well, I thought that was going to happen again, or at least the possibility was there. Guess what? It didn't happen again. Not even close. We get a guy like Aaron Maté who admits that the books he's read on the Kennedy presidency are by Seymour Hersh and Noam Chomsky. What the heck kind of journalism is that? Like I wrote in the article, that's like saying your two sources for the Kennedy assassination are Bugliosi and Posner. I mean, that's just ridiculous. That's embarrassing. Okay. And the other gas bag on the show, Chris Hedges, he also quoted Seymour Hersh. Well, take a look at my two-part article from a few months ago called Cy Hersh Falls on His Face Again and Again and Again. And you'll see why it's so worthless to use Cy Hersh's book in any kind of discussion about the Kennedy presidency. It's actually worse than worthless. It's pernicious, you know. And the guy's still, he's still BSing us in his latest column, which I wrote about in part two of that article. All right. So it's just ridiculous, to even say that. All right. And so I decided in that article, that I was going to go ahead and pierce the helium balloon that was Chris Hedges and Aaron Maté about the Kennedy presidency. All right, because they obviously are not even very well informed about that. One of the things we try to do in the film, especially the long version, JFK Destiny Betrayed, was to show the global consequences of what happened after Kennedy's assassination. And we used some very good authorities on that. You know, and we showed how many of these were very, very bad, especially for the people who ended up being the victims, like in Indonesia and Congo. All right. You know, those are, I believe, you know, we had Richard Mahoney, okay, who wrote that wonderful book, JFK Ordeal in Africa, about Congo. And then we had Brad Simpson and Lisa Peace talking about Indonesia. All right. And I don't think it gets very much better than that. And that's all you have to look at. And so I don't believe those two subjects even came up, okay, during that discussion. All right, so let's go to June the 29th. Jason Hassler. All right. Jim, I can't thank you enough for helping answer my JFK assassination question. My two girls are going to freak out when I tell them I wrote you and you actually answered our questions and gave us the book for the information we asked about. We just bought it. I was trying to explain the JFK assassination to my kids. I realize there is so much information, it's hard to even know where to start or explain it all. Then along came the Oliver Stone documentaries that explain the updates on the case, since information, okay, is finally being made available to the public. We loved the movies. I watched them with my two daughters and told them these films will explain the JFK assassination. We couldn't get enough. We were glued to the TV for both the 2-hour and the 4-hour series. I just wanted to say thanks for all your dedication and sharing of your knowledge. You are a national treasure. My kids and I did have 3 more questions you could answer. We personally believe the Parkland physicians and medical staff and basically the enlisted personnel at Bethesda, most officers involved seem to have different versions that the enlisted personnel or FBI agents at the autopsy. Well, actually, I don't think that's accurate. I think one of the things we did in the film is we showed that the FBI agents and the other people all agreed that there was this hole in the back of Kennedy's head. Okay. You know, on JFK's wounds, throat wound from the front, head wound from the front. Okay. Our question is about the Zapruder film. When you watch it, it's obvious there was a headshot from the front because of the body movement, but you don't see any damage to the right posterior side of JFK's skull. Is there any logical reason that no damage to the back of JFK's head is easily seen in the film compared with the explosion on the anterior side of the skull? In my mind, I've never been able to comprehend the body movement, but no visible posterior head wound. That is, I would expect the head explosion to be on the posterior side of the head since the body... Okay, I answered this question before. Okay, I don't know if it was this person but or another person. As the Wilkinson husband and wife team have noted, okay, and they both work in the film business, all right, in their copy of the film, which is a third generation copy, okay, there is what appears to be a black patch over the back of Kennedy's head. And what they observe on this, what's so odd about it, is that it has straight edges to it, okay? And so this is a problem, and they've tried to solve this, okay, by going down to the Sixth Floor Museum to try and find the original Time Life magazine transparencies, okay, to see if it's there or not, all right? And in fact, David Mantic writes about this in his book, which I reviewed, all right? And both Mantic and Wilkinson have said that they've been given the runaround on this, okay, because they'll go to the Sixth Floor Museum. Then they'll say it's at the National Archives. Okay, then the National Archives will say, no, it's at Time Life. Okay, and so it's obviously a shell game. All right, okay, and so, and Mantic wrote about this pretty well in his book, JFK Paradoxes. All right, and I think Sidney plans on releasing a documentary on this issue. All right, so that's the best answer to that question. Number two, I think it was Custer's ARB deposition that he said that Ebersole drew with a pencil on one x-ray to indicate an entrance wound, but was then told by someone at the autopsy to stop drawing on the x-ray. I think it was Berkeley. Then Ebersole burned a hole in one x-ray at the exact spot that was considered a bullet entrance by accident. I believe Custer also stated that Ebersole destroyed the x-ray logbook sheet for the day pertaining to x-rays at the autopsy, and that Saturday morning after Ebersole came back from the White House, he asked Gerald to tape metal fragments onto pieces of JFK skull and then x-ray them. I believe Ebersole said the x-rays were needed to make a bust of JFK's head. The last part of this, because he's asking me if this is information is accurate. The last part of this is accurate, okay, about Ebersole coming back from the White House and asking Custer to tape metal fragments on a piece of JFK's skull and then x-ray them. And this was supposed to, that part of it is true. I don't recognize the other part, the other parts that he's talking about here, about drawing a pencil on an x-ray to indicate an x-ray wound, and someone told him to stop, and then burning a hole in one x-ray, and the logbook sheet destroyed. I don't recognize that stuff. Okay, so if you can give me a better source on that, I'll go ahead and look that up. But I don't recall seeing that. All right. Three, I also thought hearing that the personnel involved with the J-Count were required to sign an NDA for a 10-year period. Yeah, they were sworn to silence after that. And then they had to be released from that, okay, I think to testify before the HSCA. And yes, it is unusual to silence somebody like that, you know, and I also agree that it was very counterproductive, you know, with the investigation, you know. But I will say that when Humes and Boswell went on television, they were released from that by, I believe, the Navy Department when Jim Garrison and the critics of the Warren Commission were making headway in 67. You know, Boswell and Humes were allowed to go in the newspapers and on TV. I think it was CBS and the Associated Press. Okay. And they were released from their bound of silence and were allowed, as long as they were defending the official story. Okay. All right. Robert Miller from Portland, Oregon. June 30th, 2023. Dear Len Osanek, as a dismounted letter carrier in San Francisco, I didn't have a vehicle. A mail truck would deliver sacks of mail to boxes along my route. I had one box where my first relay was always a little late. So I'd strike up conversations with a disabled vet who lived there. This was in the early 90s, and he was talking about his time in service in a group of Army Rangers in the early 60s. He said that at the time he was stationed in Fort Gordon, if there was a country that needed intervention, the Army would load his unit on planes, all right, and bring them to the targeted country. At the time, they would offload them and then give them orders like, if you see a black face on the street, shoot them. Well, it's a pretty general order, isn't it? Okay. And by the way, I think that Fort Gordon is in Georgia. Okay. One day, his unit was loaded with their gear into a long-distance plane. They took off and did not land for over 24 hours, so the plane must have been refueled in the air. When they landed, it was back at Fort Gordon. After they got off the plane, they found out that Kennedy had been killed. An Army unit full of expert marksmen who saw duty putting down riots in Caribbean countries were in the air before, during, after the assassination of JFK, were up in the air and ready to be dropped into any area in the U.S. if something went wrong and people saw through the assassination and began rioting. I know nothing more than that. I don't know if there was any paper trail. But if there is, or if there was someone who had proof of this, it would show how far the planning went, that the Army was ready to back a failed or sloppy coup attempt, whatever, if Dallas hadn't gone as planned. Perhaps a listener or your guest, Jimmy D., might be able to fill out some of this story. Well, I wish I could. Have you ever heard anything like this, Len?
No, I hadn't heard that at all. He's telling firsthand from you know, his anecdote of talking to somebody who was there. But John Judge has alluded to things like that. Various things happened that you think that the military of America was ready for something. I think John said that pilots told him that the launch codes were missing from some of the bombers. They were taken out so that there couldn't be accidentally a nuclear bomb or somebody set something off and that. You know, just, you know, anecdotal stories. That's not from Lee Oswald, right? That's from the people who planned this. And, when, you know, you're talking about guys like Joint Chiefs of Staff, Alan Dulles, these kind of people who really had power. And like he says, the power to put in a squad of specialists ready to be moved wherever something might happen. And yeah, they flew around until they were given the all safe signal.
All right, then he continues. On another topic, I was intrigued by a passage in Harvey and Lee about the HUAC report. That's the House Un-American Activities. That hadn't been declassified, which contained Mrs. M. Oswald, 1941, Nazis in New Jersey. I've come across other information about Harvey Oswald's possible assignment to the Boys Reformatory at Bordertown, New Jersey, when he was sent to that institution in New York City. I've also seen that one of the psychiatrists who examined young Oswald in New York also worked the mind control program at Bordentown. Anything on that you or one of your guests might know? Well, Len Osanek has 5 hours of interviews coming up with John Armstrong himself. So I don't know if he touched upon those issues, but he might have. All right. So go to the horse's mouth, so to speak. Okay. And John is the horse's mouth. Yeah. Even if you have to go to Hawaii to talk to him. What a terrible penalty having to go to Hawaii to talk to him. Yeah.
Well, anyway, yeah.
Did you mention either of those two in the interview with John?
No, basically John is discussing an article he's going to be releasing, and it was specifically about topics and that I don't recall that one. My God, I'm working on the first hour right now. I've been working on that for quite a while. And maybe I'll have it finished by November.
All right, then you know what I'll do then? By November? Len, this is July.
Yeah, well, you try going through 5 hours.
Okay.
No, I mean, what we're doing is we're putting video to it. We're breaking
you
it
are.
Up. Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. So it's going to be, you know, not quite like 50 Reasons for 50 Years, but even if I break it into four 1 hour chunks and then something extra there at the end, it's very specific to what John wanted to talk about, you know.
Okay. What I'll do then is I'll go ahead and email this to either John or his right-hand man, who was Jim Hargrove, and I'll ask him about it. And then if there's any positive reaction, I'll bring it up the next time I'm on. Okay?
Yeah, all perfect. Right. Yeah.
So that's the questions for this week. As Dean Martin used to say, keep those letters coming in at the end of his show. Okay? Keep those cards and letters coming in. All right? And I'll be glad to keep on answering the questions for the very best JFK radio show on the air, Len Osanek.
Okay, well, thanks, Jim. Thanks so much. Okay. And is there any other news regarding Oliver Stone's DVD that you wrote? I know every now and then you say it's number 4, number 5, number 3 in DVD sales and downloads and that.
Yeah, the amazing thing about this thing, okay, this has been out there now for over 1 year. Okay, let me say that again. This has been out there now for over 1 year. And usually a DVD sale will hit its peak in the first couple of months. Well, JFK Revisited is in the top 15, still in the top 15, if you can believe it, in documentaries.
Yeah, right. And like as of this fall, I say, you know, November, because it's going to be the 60th anniversary. So you can bet, well, people in school in September and October, you know, are going to be tackling this topic for the 60th anniversary.
Mm-hmm. I have no doubt or little doubt that we're going to be back in the top 5, okay, come November. And that will mean that the DVD has been a top seller for what's going to be around 15 months, more than that, 16 months, you know, and that is just phenomenal. Like I tried to explain on this show, since I'm familiar with the movie business, okay, usually a film will be released about 3 to 6 months after, a DVD rather, will be released 3 to 6 months after the actual theatrical release of the film. You know, today, of course, there's a lot of streaming going on, you know, and we were doing that. We did a theatrical release. We did a streaming. We were on 7 platforms as far as streaming went. Okay. And then 1 year after the film was released, the DVD came out through Shout Factory. And they did a very nice job on this. Okay. I believe they have the 2-hour version. They have the 4-hour version. And they have a commentary track by me and Oliver. All right. Like I said, this didn't come out till a year later. All right. And like I said, a DVD is supposed to peak and then disappear after 2 or 3 months. Okay. Well, that hasn't been the case here. And the most phenomenal part about it is still that high in the DVD sales, even though it's being streamed. Okay, you know, even though you can rent it, all right, you know, that's what's so phenomenal about this. So we're actually getting at this late date, and I have to say this is 2 years after the film made its premiere, okay, at the Cannes Film Festival, all right? So you can either go ahead and buy the DVD, which I recommend you do, all right? Or you can rent it. It's still available at numerous platforms, okay? You can get it at Amazon, for example, for $2, okay?
Yeah, sometimes they rent it for 24 hours or 48 yeah. hours and whatever, or just buy it. But I think the good thing is that by you purchasing it, you support the Shout Factory for putting their money up, and then right. you support, you know, Oliver's work. This is something that they call a passion project.
Okay, Rob Wilson
yeah.
doesn't get enough credit. He's the producer. He sold the project to a British company. They're the ones who financed it. And then there was another British company that was a distributor. I mean, isn't that incredible that we couldn't get an American distributor? We had to go to the United Kingdom, okay, to get a producer and a distributor, okay? And so they went ahead, and they're the ones who put up the money and then distributed the film. But I have to give Oliver credit for going to the Cannes Film Festival, because I believe the Cannes Film Festival is what really cinched the deal. I believe that we sold in something like 11 different countries or regions, okay, because of the premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, you know, and then because of that theatrical release, you know, over some very big distribution companies like Sky in the United Kingdom, that's how we got the Shout Factory interested, okay, in doing the DVD. They were reluctant to do it at first. If anything, I believe they undersold the product. I think we should have had a more aggressive campaign in the United Kingdom and in Australia, because those were two really big markets for us. In Australia, they bought the four-part series. Okay, they didn't just do the JFK Revisited. They did JFK Destiny Betrayed. They did the four-part series. Okay, and we got a lot of really good press in Australia. Okay, I mean, a lot. And so I believe that they should have been more aggressive in selling it throughout the English-speaking world. You know, I think we would have done even better. Okay, we had the potential to do even better than we did. You can get it on Hulu also. You can rent it on Hulu. And there's about, I think, Vudu also, you know, there's about 7 platforms that you could rent it on. But like Len said, you should really get the DVD. The DVD was a pretty good production, I believe. And like I said, I think we're going to go through the roof come the anniversary. Okay. And by the way, there's still a couple of nice trailers. Altitude Films was a distributor of the picture. And they put together a couple of nice, well, actually more than that, about 3 pretty good trailers on YouTube. And you can still see some of them. All right.
All right. Good, good. Anyway, okay, Jim. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time tonight. I'll talk to you in near future. It's really a shame about Biden and this whole documents. Everybody go to Kennedy's and King and just see, let them rub it in your face how they are not going to release the documents that show what really happened. And they're going to stick with waiving the Warren Commission. I mean, the people who support the Warren Commission, don't they think something's, you know, wrong? Don't they smell a rat? You know, like, how can they, you just know that the way they're digging in and denying everything, and then the way they're blatantly, like you said one time after the AARB had disbanded, there was a burn party going on, and there was a lot of high-fiving going on, and they were going to never let the American people know what happened.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and that's just shows the real, you know, who really pulled the strings and had such a good president removed.
Okay.
All right. All right, Len. Thanks so much.
Have a good night, partner. Yeah.